This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As a kid in Brooklyn, growing up with his little brother Eddie, Charlie Murphy's nickname was Charlie Wally. As a teenager, he adopted the name Omar Allah when he became a member of a religious group called the Five Percenters. He was also known as Lil Boss to fellow members of the King Pythons gang in Roosevelt, Long Island. He served in the Navy, where he said he was called a lot of things. Worked as the head of security for his by then famous sibling and inevitably known as Eddie Murphy's brother. He became a screenwriter and an actor, and when he got a part as a featured player on cable TV's Chappelle Show, people started to combine his names in one shout, Charlie Murphy! He's now written a book about finding his own voice and his own identity as a stand-up comedian. If you'd like to talk with Charlie Murphy about any of his names or his career in comedy, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, we'll talk with the chief prosecutor at the Rwanda Genocide War Crimes Tribunal. But first, Charlie Murphy joins us here in Studio 4A. His new book with Chris Millis is called The Making of a Stand-Up Guy. And thanks very much for coming in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We'll also take some questions from the audience here in Studio 4A. There's a name I left out of that list that I wanted to ask about, and that is Ratman.
Ratman, yeah. Oh, wow. Ratman was actually, that was my first part in a feature where I got to make a sound, but it wasn't a word. It was a grunt. And it was Marion Van Peebles' TV show, Sonny Spoon.
And what was Ratman's distinguishing?
Ratman was supposed to be this Jamaican that chewed his own arm off, dove in the water, and swam from Jamaica to the States with one arm.
That's a tough dude.
Tough dude, man.
I guess all he does have to do
and
is...
he had his other arm in his back pocket like a sack lunch as he swam.
This was a tragedy, no doubt.
I was glad to get the job, man. I was happy, man. I had been laying on the floor. I had a friend named Desmond Gums. I was laying, he let me sleep on the floor of his house for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had my own place to live and all that, but I couldn't afford to bring my whole family and everything, you know, so I had to go by myself, and that's what I had to do to get my feet wet and go on auditions or whatever, so that's what I did.
You write, after you'd already left working for your brother by that time, and you said in your book that you never got any part or any movie script accepted because you were Eddie Murphy's brother?
Pretty much, yeah. It was for a long time, it seemed like they was having fun. Like, okay, he thinks he's going to get it. We picked the other guy. You know, yeah, that was happening a lot. But
you have to hear no a lot when you're an actor.
Yeah, I don't think I heard no more than anybody else. You know, when I look back on it, everybody has to deal with that.
Yet you got into the business, well, later than most.
No. If you really check, I've been in the business since I was 9.
Well,
I mean, as far as stand-up comedy, I got in the business later than most, yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason behind that was, you know, the opportunity wasn't there. Prior to Chappelle's show, you know, no one would have even listened to me. In the frame of, oh, he's trying to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your brother's Eddie, so what are you doing? But once Chappelle's show came on and it took off the way it did, that erased that. You know, people were like, okay, we want to see more of you. So I took it and ran with it.
You have to explain that part when you were 9 years old. You were in a movie when you were
I was 9 years old, I was in a movie called The Landlord with Pearl Bailey, Lou Gossett, and Bo Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And it was directed by... Neil Ashby.
And Hal Ashby.
Hal Ashby, excuse me, Hal Ashby, yeah.
And tell us what your part consisted of.
Stealing. I stole hubcaps off of Bo Bridges' car, yeah.
What part of your inner self did you have to reach to do
well,
that?
Well, there was no part of me that was representing the guy that would do that back then. I was 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't need money back then, so... They was like, we want you to go over here and take this screwdriver and pop the hubcaps off, and when this guy comes out, he's going to start chasing you. I was like, okay. And we did it. And the funny part was how the family when the movie came out, we all got dressed up like it was Easter Sunday. We went to the movie theater, like, Charlie's movie's coming. Charlie's movie. We got to the movie theater, and my scene came on, blip, it was off. We were still sitting there with our popcorn, like, now what do we do now?
You know? Now it's somebody else's movie for the rest of
the
time.
Yeah. But that was the beginning. That was the first one. Yeah.
And even then, at that age, you said you and everybody else in your family already expected that if somebody was going to make it in the entertainment business, it was going to be a
No, it wasn't that we expected it. That's not what we didn't expect it. We thought Eddie was crazy. Man, nobody expected that. You have a kid telling you that when he grows up, he's going to be essentially what he is right now. And so, yeah, you don't. I mean, if your kid told you that tomorrow, would you believe him?
No.
Exactly.
No.
And that's what our family reacted the same way. It was, oh, yeah, yeah. Here is a game with the Stevie Wonder. But, you know, that was somebody that was driven. And, you know, now as an adult, I look back and I look at all of these. I watch a lot of biography and history channel and stuff. And I see that's one thing that a lot of people who are very successful have in common is that they knew at a young age exactly where they want to go with it. You know?
And you write repeatedly in this book that you never knew what you were going day to day doing the next thing.
Yeah. And I'm still doing that in a sense because, you know, I never know what opportunity may come up tomorrow. You know, I just finished doing three films, and all three of them were, at the end of the film when we finished, they were not the script I was presenting with because we changed everything right on the set, you know?
Let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Charlie Murphy is our guest. His new book is called The Making of a Stand-Up Guy. And let's see if we can get Jeremy on the line. Jeremy with us from Union City in California.
Hi, how's it going?
All right.
What's up, Jeremy?
Hey, Charlie. Man, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
All right.
So I saw you in San Francisco with Dave Chappelle.
Okay.
At the Punchline. I think Paul Mooney was there.
That was a while ago. You saw him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the one where Al Gore was in-house watching y'all. And I was very impressed. Anyway. I just want to know how much, like, I love Paul Mooney, you know? He's, like, from a kid, I've been watching him. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, like, when y'all met and maybe how much he's influenced you.
Paul Mooney, I won't say influenced, but he gave me a big shot. I've known him for many years because I met Paul Mooney when he, it's funny. Me and my brother were driving through the city one day and he seen a movie set.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Brewster's Main. Richard Pryor was filming a movie. He said, that's Richard Pryor's set. And I was like, okay. And he drives over there and he takes me on the bus. And now I'm standing right in front of Richard Pryor, which that blew me away, you know. Maybe a couple of months prior to that meeting Richard Pryor, we heard about this dude named Rashawn. That was Richard's bodyguard.
Karate dude.
And Rashawn was supposed to be like, you know, he could fly and all this other stuff. I mean, that's the way the story sounded. And finally, we go on the bus, and there's this man sitting with, you know, clean-shaven face, head, you know, with all white suit on, white shoes. And when we walked on the bus, he looked at us, but he didn't speak. And then my brother didn't make no big deal about it. Mm-hmm. Like, we walked by him, and I'm going, that must be Rashawn, you know. Then I started going, well, how could he? You're supposed to be a tough fatty, got on all white. You must really be tough, man. You're going to get your clothes dirty. You know, and I'm just sitting there the whole time on the bus, you know, talking to Eddie and Richard, and we leave the bus. I said, yeah, that other guy, that was Rashawn, right? He was like, Rashawn, that was a comedian. That was Paul Mooney. And that's who it was. That's how I met him.
And there's another story you tell in the book that later you and your brother spent an incredible amount of time trying to figure out how to get his hat off.
Oh, that was my other brother.
Oh, Vern. Your other brother, Vern.
Yeah, not Eddie. My youngest brother and my, you know, we used to do a tricks that people wanted. We was on the road. We used to punish whoever was with us. We'd get bored. We'd come up with, you know.
Practical jokes, yeah.
Throw your shoes in the garbage. Anything. You know how you hang your shoes on the door at night in the hotel?
Mm-hmm.
We would find out what room to throw your shoes in the garbage. Next day, you look for the shoes. They're gone. By the end of the tour, you spent $2,000-$3,000 on shoes. That was one of our things. We thought that Paul was wearing a toupee, right? And I would never do that now. That was much younger. Let's pull it off on the bus. That's what we thought that would be funny. And we was trying to figure out how to get his hat off for like 2.5 months, and we could never get it off. And the night we gave up is when I said, you know what? This is how we're going to get it off. I'm going to pull a fire alarm in the hotel, and you bang on the door and say, fire, fire. And my brother said, okay. And I did it. And Paul Mooney, my brother went bang, boom, 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 fire, fire. You heard Paul Mooney's, and then he opened the door and he was butt naked with his hat on.
Jeremy, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
Let's see if we go next to this is this is Dave. Dave's with us from Traverse City in Michigan.
Hi, guys. Hi from Michigan. Hey, Mr. Murphy. Just wanted to pass along. Thanks. I was signed overseas in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and your videos, your DVDs on the Chappelle Show, especially True Hollywood Story, absolute classics, and made a difference to a lot of us where it wasn't such a fun time, but you really made a difference. So thanks much.
Hey, I appreciate that.
Did you realize when you were making those shows?
No. As a matter of fact, there's an actress by the name of Boucher, right? Boucher, I'm saying her name right? And Boucher, yeah. When we were first talking about doing those sketches, she pulled me to the side and was like, "You're really gonna allow them to do that on television?" I was like, "Yeah." She said, "But it's true." And I was like, "It's not gonna be exactly the way I explained it once Dave gets finished," and it wasn't. Dave Chappelle, you know, he's a brilliant actor and a comedian, and he went on and he took it to the next level.
Were those his lines or were those Rick James's lines?
They were Rick James's lines reconstituted. Dave Chappelle. Come on, man. He made that insane, man.
Thanks very much, Dave, for the phone call.
He made it insane.
Bye-bye. Charlie Murphy will also tell a story in his book about his time in high school when a classmate held a gun to his head and pulled the trigger. We'll talk more about that and some of the other lighter moments as well. If you'd like to talk with Charlie Murphy about his career in comedy, our phone number is 800-989-8255 or drop us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conant. Stick around. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today here in Studio 4A for this part of the program is Charlie Murphy, his new book, The Making of a Stand-Up Guy. And that title, it goes two directions. You're talking about finding your own voice as
a
comedian.
Right.
But also being a stand-up guy.
Being a stand-up guy, exactly.
Discipline is what you write a lot about.
Well, I didn't always think of it, I think now. I had a different, you know, I used to have a different way of looking at life. You know, that wasn't, I consider myself more of a spiritual person now. And it's all about education. You know, if you don't know things, you know, you just go by your instinct or, you know, then it don't always work out for you.
How did it happen that you found yourself with a gun to your head in high school?
Well, I used to have a lot of fights. I used to have a lot of fights. And this one particular gentleman, I made the mistake of announcing that what I was going to do to him when I see him. And when I see him, I'm going to rip him from limb to limb. Blah, 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 blah. You tell him when I see him, blah, 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 click. You know, that's kind of, and that's why I learned not to do that, you know.
We have a questioner here at the microphone in the audience. Go ahead, please.
Yes.
What's up, man?
Charlie, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Same here.
I'm a stand-up comedian myself. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, name, I was predisposed. My name is Carlos Murphy. So I think...
Okay. So you got to go down to Latin America and get jumping in.
You know what? Real talk, I was telling my buddy back there, the one who's laughing like a Halloween character. I used to say that when I went on stage. I used to say that my name is Carlos Murphy. I'm the cheaper Latin American version of Charlie Murphy. That's how I was introduced myself. I thought it was funny. All right. Doesn't kill here. I was wondering, though, you have at least, I would think, a million and one stories, and you already have the exposure from Chappelle's Show and everything. Mm-hmm. Any possibility that we'll see Charlie Murphy's show? Something along
Oh, yeah, man. We got some stuff in the works right now, man. With Terry Crews is a good friend of mine, the one from Everyone Hates Chris. We're developing some stuff right now. So, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Right. Welcome back to D.C.
Hey, thanks for having me back, man. That's what's up.
Let's get a caller on the line, and this is Josh. Josh with us on the road in Kentucky. Kentucky. Go ahead.
Hi, Charlie. How you doing?
What's up, Josh?
I'm driving right now from North Carolina all the way to Montana. Just enjoying listening to you. So I wanted to ask you, you know, you said you started your stand-up career later in life. Did you have to learn how to write jokes, how to, you know, did you have to learn the dynamics of the jokes you were writing before you went out there and tried
And that's one of the things I tell people that want to get into stand-up, you know. If you the guy that's, you know, that's naturally funny, you know, those are the guys that usually want to give it a shot. Don't think that that's all is necessary. You know, you're going to have to learn how to express yourself to a group of people that don't know you. See, a lot of people are funny in the barbershop, but everybody in the barbershop knows them, you know. Or they're funny at school or at work, but everybody that's there work, they're friends. You know, when you do, as a professional, you're going into a town, these people don't know you personally or nothing, and your jokes have to make them laugh. And that's where the work comes in, learning how to do that, learning how to develop your voice in that area. In that
area. You were also a screenwriter, and you wrote...
I am also
a screenwriter. you've written jokes for movies, and there's an interesting part in your book where you say, you know, it's really different writing a joke for a movie than it is for stand-up.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, if you write a joke for a movie, for instance, right?
Mm-hmm.
They paid you for the script. They might not even use the joke. You still got your money. But if you write a joke in stand-up and it don't work, you're going to get, you know, you're going to feel it right there. You don't get paid. You feel it, you know, like somebody put a cigarette out on you. It doesn't feel good.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Josh. Drive carefully.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And let's go to the microphone here in the audience.
So, Charlie, tell us about the first time you bumped into Rick James after the Chappelle show.
The first time I bumped into him after the Chappelle show?
Yeah.
It was cool because Rick was... The Chappelle Show, everybody remembers, Rick James went through a bad turn in his life, and he went to jail and all this other stuff. And when he got out, he was kind of discredited, you know, in the industry as far as, you know, he was a multimillionaire, had everything you want to call Puffy and Jay-Z, these guys today. Rick James had the same thing. And, you know, unfortunately, the drugs took it from him, and he went to jail. And in the process of doing that, just like with any other addict, he created a whole bunch of enemies or whatever. And when he came out, his spirit was kind of beat down, but he wasn't beat out, you know. He was still like family to us, so we weren't his friends because he was Rick James. We was his friends because we liked him as a person.
We should explain the character. The bit you did on the Chappelle Show, the recurring bit, was Two Tales of Hollywood, those stories about you and when you palled around with Rick James.
And Rick was actually in it.
Yeah.
He wasn't like, you know. But to make a long story short, he agreed to do those sketches, and when they came out, it reinvigorated his career. I don't know if anybody remembers, but when he did the BET Awards, he sang Love Them and Leave Them from the audience, and he got up. It was like the moment was really, it was almost like, I'm not going to say it was equivalent, but it was almost like when Michael did the moonwalk for the first time. It electrified the audience, and he went up on stage. And the reason why the audience was electrified, because they had all been watching the Chappelle Show sketch, you know? And then Rick, you know, he was dressed like kind of like the Lion and the Wiz anyway, so he had his outfit on, singing the songs. Like, you know, people were really connecting it to Dave and everything. And then when Rick said, you know, you know my name, I'm Rick James B, whatever, he got a standing ovation for that. And that sparked the tour, and Rick was back on the road again. He was doing shows. It was good. It was a good thing.
Let's get another caller in. This is Matt. Matt from Fort Myers in Florida.
All right, hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
Can I first say, before I begin, Charlie Murphy, I am a huge fan of your work on the Chappelle Show and also some of your stand-up work. I think you're hilarious.
Thank you very much.
Just some of his stand-up work?
Well, all of it, I guess.
Okay.
But my question is, Charlie Murphy, you are indeed Eddie Murphy's younger brother. Older brother.
Uh-huh.
You look like him. And now that you've made yourself famous, looking back on your career, did you ever find moments in time where you felt overshadowed by your brother?
No, not at all. Because I never, you know, what I'm doing right now was never foreseen by me. It was, when I was working with him, and I decided I wanted to try something different. I started writing. I didn't initially go. I'm going to be an actor. I started writing first, and I made a little money doing that, but it wasn't enough to sustain me forever. And in the meantime, that's what made me you know, start trying to get back into acting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I never looked at him like he was overshadowing me because, you know, Eddie Murphy has been the huge part of American fabric that he is since he was 19 years old. So there was never a point where I was like comparing myself to him or anything like that.
There know? Is interesting. You write about in all of the endeavors in your life, you're always mm-hmm. part of a team. Whether it was the gang or the Navy or part of Eddie's security team.
Right.
And even when you're writing for the movies, that's a big collaborative effort once the writer's finished with it. Stand-up, you say, you found your own voice.
Well, stand-up is done by yourself. You know, there's nobody backing you up. There's no pyrotechnics going on. There's no flashy dancers. When you go up there, you're by yourself.
You might not want to work in the flashy dancers. That might be good.
Nah. Flashy dancing.
Let's get a question here on the microphone in the audience.
Hey, Mr. Murphy, how
What's
you doing?
What's up, bro?
Hey, question for you is, how do you equate being conscious or being spiritually awakened with being a comedian? A lot of the times...
Well, I'm going to tell you something. My spirituality is... It's all about me being the best person that I could possibly be, and the best parent that I could be to my kids. And I look for things that's going to guide me to be that, you know. As far as comedy is concerned, the spirituality in that is that I say my prayers before I go on stage and I don't get shot before the show is over.
You say your prayers before you go on stage, and then you do a fair amount of blue material.
I do adult material.
Adult material.
I don't perform in high school lunchrooms. I'm talking to grown people, so they drinking. You know, come on, man.
All right. Here's an email question from Bridget in Minneapolis. I was wondering how your experiences with such a seemingly serious group of people as the 5%ers, also known as the Nation of Gods and Earths, has influenced your comedy.
It hasn't. I mean, you know.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago, and... jokes is what kind of made me have to be out of that situation because, you know, I would question things. I had an analytical mind back then. And if you tell me something and profess it to be the truth, I don't just accept it, you know, because you said it, you know. Or if I seen it on the news or whatever, I don't just go, oh, yeah, that's the truth because so-and-so said it. You know, it's the truth when I can tell you why it's the truth. And if I can't do that, you know, you obviously haven't explained to me why it's the truth. And that's what I felt like when I was part of that organization. Like, you know, I was being told things, but the explanation that beyond the explanation I was getting was not there.
Let's get another caller in. Dane. Dane with us from Boise.
Hi. How you doing? I would like to start to say that I love Charlie Murphy's work on the on Chappelle Show, but what I wanted to ask about was the work on Boondocks that you did with the
Oh, well, we got another season coming, too. We just did another season of Boondocks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's like I want to give credit to the creator, but I can't remember his name.
Aaron Magruder,
yes, thank you.
Yeah,
to put it mildly, I would call it high octane racial comedy. And I was wondering if you were going to be doing any more voice acting work because you just seem perfect for it.
Well, I love doing it, but I never hire myself, so...
If the people at the Simpsons are listening,
to be seen whether I'm gonna do any more voiceover work.
How does that work? I mean, do you go in? I mean, are you watching the cartoon as you do the voiceover?
No. They have these lights, and when it's a tone that goes like boom, 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 and when you hear that last tone,
mm-hmm.
you have a script in front of you. Start talking.
So you're not syncing up with the characters
now?
They sync it up later.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
The dialogue between you and Samuel L. Jackson, though, is like that was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, man. Aaron Magruder's crazy, man. That's why I love being on the show. I love being involved with anything that's going to make people talk, you know? It's that simple. Anything that's going to make... Whether you're saying something bad or good, you're talking about what we did, then I achieved my objective, you know?
All right, thank you much. I'm looking forward to the next season.
Thanks very much for the call, Dane. Another question from the audience here in 4A.
Charlie, good question for you. What is the mantra of a stand-up guy?
The mantra? My mantra is, like I said, just remain being a positive person, you know what I'm saying? And approach life as a positive being. Don't complain about what you ain't got. Focus on what you do got. Be grateful for it, you know, and just keep trying to create new and more ingenious jokes. I mean, people would be surprised if you came to my room and see me sleeping at night. I'd be sleep like this.
He's laying back with his eyes open.
That's right. Sleep with my eyes open because I'm always trying to come up with a new joke, man.
It's that tough a business.
You know how many comedians it are? That's another thing. When Eddie and those guys came up, it was way less comedians. Because of Eddie's success and because of the success of Chris Rock and Bernie Mac and these other guys, a lot of young people seen that and they're like, yo, wait a minute, I can do that. So now there's a lot of comedians, more than ever right now.
And you write that there is sort of a fraternity. You hang out with each other. You support each other.
Yeah.
You're also viciously competitive.
Yeah. It's kind of like two dogs eating at the same bowl.
Our guest is Charlie Murphy. Yeah. His book is The Making of a Stand-Up Guy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in on the phone and go to Chris. Chris with us from Owensboro in Kentucky. Chris, are you there? I guess Chris isn't there. And we'll go instead to Reef. Reef with us from Laramie, Wyoming.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
Neil, love the show.
Thank you.
What's that, Reef?
I'm an aspiring comedian here in Laramie, and I'm trying to find my way to get out. And I was wondering if Charlie had any advice where to go and how to keep surviving through the tough beats of stand-up.
I think you just find I-80 and head either east or west.
I didn't say that. Nah, man, if you really want to get into comedy, man, the two hotbeds are, obviously Hollywood, Los Angeles, and New York. Those are places where you're going to have to go cut your teeth at, if you really want to get into it.
You live outside of New York?
I live in New Jersey.
Yeah. Yeah.
But all the clubs that I went to for my early training or whatever, it was the whole New York grid. We just went from club to club every night. We would do as many as possible. And then I would go home the next day. I would write down what I did wrong, go back the next day and try to, make it better.
It was interesting. I got the chance to meet you briefly after you did a show at the Improv here in Washington, D.C. about a month ago.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
And you were saying how much things were really going great for you. You had a book coming out, which we'd scheduled you to do all that already. You're working on a movie. All this, you're selling out comedy clubs. And I assume this is one of the nicer green rooms in one of the nicer comedy clubs, and it was not that great.
Nah. I'm going to tell you something before I diss the green room. I love the Improv in D.C. and the people come to support my shows. But the green room, they make you it's tight in there.
It's
designed for you to want to get out of there, to want to get on the stage. Yeah.
Well, let's see if we get a question from the audience here.
Yeah, I saw the camera panned to Prince at the Minnesota game yesterday, and I just died laughing. Not that Prince couldn't be at the game, but it immediately made me think of the skit.
Because you've seen his clothes. He
did have on the blouse. He did.
About Prince on
and so I was just wondering, to piggyback on the other question, have you seen or talked to Prince?
I've seen Prince. It was funny. We was in Vegas. I did the House of Blues, and the show was sold out. It was during the NBA All-Star game. Mm-hmm. So it was a great turnout and everything. The show went great. And when it was over, I had all this adrenaline. I was pumped up. And they said, well, you want to go to Prince's club? And I said, yeah, let's go to his club. And we went to his club. And as soon as we walked in the front door, you heard the music before you got in. But as soon as we walked in the front door, Prince had came off the stage and was walking around through the audience. And we walked through the front door and literally bumped into him. And he looked at me. And he did like this, like gave me a look like, oh, it's you. kept on playing. It was funny.
There's we just have a few seconds left, but there's a story you tell in the book about you and your brother Eddie going to a celebrity look-alike contest.
Oh yeah, man, that was a horrible night for me, man.
At Chippendales.
This was that happened right when I got out of the military. You know what I'm saying? We was going to all these clubs every night, and then one night. Don't get me wrong, Chippendales, a lot of girls go to Chippendales. If you're a real hunter, go to Chippendales. So they had the lookalike name. So when we went in there, everybody was looking at my brother and looking at me going, oh, so you must be the Eddie Murphy lookalike. And I was like, no, man. And then we sat down and watched the show. And I remember that night, two Michael Jackson lookalikes got into a fist fight over who could do Michael the best. And this dude came out and performed Purple Rain. He looked exactly like Prince with Jimmy Durante's nose. Like, he had the big giant nose. And...
Charlie Murphy, thank you so much for being with us today. The book is The Making of a Stand-Up Guy, Charlie Murphy.
That's what's up.
Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.